Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never. And I can't say that what's going on in America is, you know, really good news. I look at the incoming president, the outgoing president, and it just seems like we're allowing ourselves to be torn because every side wants to have their, I'll call it retribution. They, you know, the left had their retribution against Trump. And now Trump is going to hopefully provide you the retribution you want. And that's not the kind that government we're supposed to have, folks, which is why we painstakingly go through all the content and documents here for you so that you don't take my word for it. You actually, you know, start understanding exactly what the framers created, what they did, because they tell you those things. So, anyway, when we look at that debt clock, please keep in mind that those numbers are fraud. We cover why and how. Don't want to do that today. I've got some content that we're going to go into today because Tammy has abandoned me. She has a very important party legislative meeting coming up this weekend, and so she's traveling to the Capitol and going to be connecting with the big wigs and all of that. And so she will hopefully have a very positive interface with many new legislators getting ready to go in and kick some butt. Anyway, if you would like to initiate, you know, an organized appeal to heaven, then you're more than welcome to do that. And if you want me to put it up on the website to invite people to your prayer group or what have you, then let me know. You can also join the Loudoun Liberty Prayer Circle, I'm sorry. And they go, well, the information is up on the Red State Talk Radio page. So by all means, you can either join them, create your own, or continue doing what you're doing. We just ask that everybody do everything they possibly can. And prayer is definitely one of those tools. So the last thing I want to cover is the importance of your campaign. Your campaign right now needs to be a public relation campaign. You need to be proving to the people these people in office are scoundrels. And actually, you need to help convince those people to not be a scoundrel because they don't even know it. Most of these people think, hey, what the heck is this person's problem? I'm just doing what I'm being told. This is how it's done. And so that's how, you know, I guess some people call it idiocracy. But that's how we get screwed over because these people don't understand what they should be doing. They don't understand the importance of that oath and why they really are taking it. So your campaign has to begin today, and you have to be attacking them against their oath. It's all about the oath. It has nothing to do with the court system because the court system is so corrupt, they don't even abide by their oath. Because every person that is in public service, whether they be a judge or not, are required to support this Constitution, not the Constitution, this Constitution. And the judges today do not support this Constitution. They support their Constitution. You realize the annotated Constitution is being, I'll just say it's being changed, and the authorship is literally underneath the jurist's hand because they're the ones that are redefining everything, and Congress and the president are just allowing this living Constitution to continually grow. Anyway, the content that we're going to cover today is the scale of liberty, the evolution of common law in America, And probably in the next week or so, we'll cover the law of nature and nature's God. Because the reason we're going to cover that, but we'll cover common law first. Because common law was the foundational law that moved this nation forward. And we'll explain that, because this is why we've already gone through the Tory Acts. You've got to, if you haven't listened to the Tory Acts, you need to go back and listen to that, because everything we're going to be doing this year will be building off what we've given you. And so, more importantly, what we're going to do is we're going to also cover James Madison's essay on property. But before I do, I just want to make a comment, because when you look at anarchists and arsonists, it's basically they feed the same thing. It's about creating fear. It's about creating anxiety. It's about creating uncertainty, which is why anarchy is one of those tools that is being used to undermine our government. Believe it or not, the Libertarian Party has been co-opted by anarchist views. When they went and divided themselves away from the Republican Party, and they created this, you know, this pledge, this credo of no violence and no physical actions, you know, they tied their hands, and what ended up happening is this is how the anarchists were able to come in. Bottom line, we have a responsibility to defend ourselves, and we actually have a responsibility to take positive action. As a matter of fact, when we look at the Monroe Doctrine is taking positive action. You must engage. You don't wait till you become overcome. You don't just sit there on your hands and be passive and say, well, I'm not going to fight until you really attack me. Okay, I know you're right here in the Western Hemisphere, but we're not going to do anything until you actually attack us. We have a bigger responsibility because we're not just some little, I'll just say, pissant country that is, you know, incapable of really defending itself. Even though it will defend itself if forced, it's really incapable. When Monroe created that Monroe Doctrine, and we kind of covered this at the end of last year, so just go back. And as a matter of fact, I still have not migrated the 2024 podcast to its archive page, to where we now have the 2025 all by itself and just starting with a clean slate. So that being said, let me first go into or cover Madison's essay on property. And this is important because, folks, what this does, what this article does, or what this essay does, is it provides some insights on the paradigm of Madison and many of the framers, because a lot of times they just didn't sit down and create desktop procedures. If you understand what a desktop procedure is, anybody in the military knows. This is the process or procedure, you know, in doing what you're supposed to be doing on a daily basis, in case of emergency, all of those types of contingencies. And so Madison kind of wrote this, to me, should have been included in the desktop procedure, because remember, we institute government, and this was a part of the Federalist Papers, the editorials, the insights on the theory of our government. And so this actually kind of talks the importance, because governments are instituted to do two things. The major two objects that governments have created is, one, to protect your life, to protect life, and two, to protect property, private property. So this essay on property is more than apropos. It really helps speak to the paradigm of and the importance of property. And so he actually states some really obvious things right up front. So let me get into this. This was March 29th, 1792. This term in particular application means, quote, that dominion, when he says this term, he's talking about property, that dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world in exclusion to every other individual, close quote. So he just defined what property was. In its larger and juster meaning, it embraces everything to which a man may attach a value and have a right, and which leaves to everyone else the like advantage. In the former sense, a man or merchandise, a man's land or merchandise or money is called his property. Now, I just want to stop right there because we talked about this with the digital currency. Money, currency, is your property. If it sits in a computer where you do not have the ability to possess it in your hand, digital and or electronic currency is not your property. This is how, you know, these hackers and these wire thieves and so forth, credit card thieves, they can steal because they're using electronic transactions and they can steal your property. And they can really hurt people, and people have been seriously hurt because of electronic fraud. So anyway, in the latter sense, a man has a property in his opinions and the free communication of them. Now, in some worlds, you can get bullied because of that, but this is where he really hits some, this is where we hit the meat, and then he goes deeper into all of this. He has a property of peculiar value in his religious opinions and in the profession and practice dictated by them. Who doesn't? So obviously I'm deviating a bit from just reading to giving you my insights or opinion. Who doesn't feel like your relationship with Christ isn't your property? It's just like your relationship with your spouse, your relationship with your children. That is your property. We don't really look at it that way, but we need to. We need to understand these things that are precious to us. Goes on and says this, is what Madison says. He has a property very dear to him in the safety and liberty of his person. He has an equal property in the free use of his faculties and free choice of the objects on which to employ them. In a word, a man is said to have a right to his property. He may be equally said, he may be equally said to have a property in his rights. So in other words, if you have a right to say what you want to say, then that means that that becomes your property, the right of being able to do that, the right to be able to actually exercise the property. If somebody takes away your ability to exercise your religious faith, to be able to go and worship how you see fit, to be able to say those things that you think need to be said, then somebody is actually taking those rights, these inalienable rights, away from you. And in essence, they've taken your property. They're stealing your property. And as long as they convince you to keep those things in check and not to use them, they have succeeded. He goes on and says, where an excess of power prevails, property of no sort is duly respected. No man is safe in his opinions, his person, his faculties, or his possessions. Where there is an excess of liberty, the effect is the same, though from an opposite cause. Government is instituted to protect property of every sort. That's him saying this. Remember, I already started this off. Governments are instituted to protect life and property, and his focus here is property, as well that which lies in the various rights of individuals as that which the term particularly expresses. This being the end, of government, that alone is the just government, which impartially secures to every man whatever is his own. According to the standard of merit, the praise of affording a just securing to property should be sparingly bestowed on a government which, however scrupulously guarding the possessions of individuals, does not protect them in the enjoyment and communication of their opinions, in which they have an equal and, in the estimation of some, a more valuable property. more sparingly should this praise be allowed to a government where a man's religious rights are violated by penalties or fettered by tests or taxed by a hierarchy. Conscience is the most sacred property of all property. I've said this before when we talk about the conscience of not getting vaccinated, the conscience, you having the right to object. You don't have to have a religious conscience. It doesn't have to be based on religion. It could be mathematical. It doesn't matter. It is your conscience, and if you have an objection, you have a right to that objection. Now, sometimes there are consequences to those, like the conscientious objector that does not want to serve his country. You could actually, without, taking away your property, without taking away your ability to conscientiously object, you could lose your citizenship. There are consequences to what we do. But you have the right to exercise them and deal with the risks and or the consequences that come. So conscience is the most sacred of all property. Other property depending in part on positive law. The exercise of that being a natural and unalienable right. To guard a man's house as his castle. To pay public and enforce private debts with the most exact faith can give no title to invade a man's conscience, which is more sacred than his castle, or to withhold from it that debt of protection for which the public faith is pledged by the very nature and original conditions of the social pact. That is not a just government, nor is property secure under it, where the property which a man has in his personal safety and personal liberty is violated by arbitrary seizures of one class of citizens for the service of the rest. In other words, those who choose not to work, and the fact that they're seizing your personal property to take care of those people who choose not to work. In other words, this is how they weaponize your property by taking it from you and giving it to those who don't have it, but they want it. A magistrate, now just remember, he wrote this in 1792, where the magistrate being a king, being the person that is the all-powerful, a magistrate issuing his warrants to a press gang would be in his proper functions in Turkey or Indostan under appellations proverbial of the most complete despotism. That is not a just government, nor is property secure under it, where arbitrary restrictions and exemptions and monopolies deny to part of its citizens that free use of their faculties and free choice of their occupations, which not only constitute their property in the general sense of the word, but are the means of acquiring property strictly so called. What must be the spirit of legislation where a manufacturer of linen cloth is forbidden to bury his own child in a linen shroud in order to favor his neighbor who manufactures woolen cloth? See, we talked about this earlier, where these concepts of where they start creating, and actually we covered this in the Articles of Association. So unfortunately, Tammy's missing this because we literally just covered this, where we were not going to abide by the customs of the burials, the coffins, and those types of things. The colonists were going to do what they felt was best. They weren't going to abide by those regulations that supported very select people in the market space. Okay, so in order to favor his neighbor who manufactures woolen cloth, where the manufacturer and wearer of woolen cloth are again forbidden the economical use of buttons of that material in favor of the manufacture of buttons of another material. A just security to property is not afforded by that government, under which unequal taxes oppress one species of property and reward another species. Let's just take this one further. Start looking in your own community and look at who has the monopoly on the services that you receive, whether that be septic pump, you know, pumping out, because you can actually see who the kings are, who actually was able to create this huge advantage over everybody else. Maybe your cable provider is a monopoly. How did they become the key provider? Remember when the internet just came out, there were all sorts of little people that were creating these interfaces where you would dial into. Now, there was these national ones like AOL. And then there was these smaller ones like, you know, Inland Internet or you know, let's just say Spokane Central or whatever the names were way back in the 90s where you used a modem dial-up. Those institutions either got bought up or they went under because they couldn't compete. And then when they went into bankruptcy, these bigger institutions came in and bought everybody up. And eventually they started moving the internet and cable television and everything else down this monopoly service. How is it that we actually have, you know, how did they even get to these advantages? How did they get there? And so, and you got to think about this, folks. When you look at Comcast, is Comcast, you know, the origins of Comcast from your state? I believe, and I don't know where CenturyLink came from, but I believe CenturyLink was big in the Pacific Northwest. I think Fios was big in the Pacific Northwest as well. The fact is, it's one thing if you have your own state company, but when the state starts creating advantages to create this monolithic power of the sole provider of all things, then we actually have a bad monopoly, because a bad monopoly is where a monopoly depends on government to protect it. A good monopoly actually is a monopoly that out there is competing and has no government preference and no government assistance in protecting it. It is literally keeping its competition at bay by its own diligence and work in serving you, the customer. I'll give you a good case in point. Alcoa. Alcoa Aluminum was a company that was actually keeping every manufacturer out of being able to refine aluminum and create aluminum products. Because, and they had no advantage from the government. Go look this up. They had no advantages from the government. And these larger corporations doing mining and manufacturing of metal products and so forth, like steel and so forth, they wanted to get into aluminum. They wanted to be the sole controllers of all the mining and everything else. And yet they couldn't penetrate the market, because every time Alcoa made an advantage and or an innovation in their processes, they would reap the harvest of those innovations, and they kept their price down. By keeping their price down, it made it impossible for anybody to come in, because they couldn't actually come in and compete with them, because they were having to do it at the old ways of the more expensive processes. So these big monoliths went to the federal government and said, hey, these guys have a monopoly. You need to regulate them. And the government forced them to raise their prices so that these other people could come in and actually compete. If you're going to tell me that all monopolies are bad, you have to start looking. All monopolies that have government protection or corporations that have any government protection are bad corporations. Corporations that are out there beating or competing and beating people, you know, in the competitive environment, those, and as long as they're not causing harm, they're literally beating you because of processes and innovations and so forth, then that is a good monopoly, because they're passing on those savings. Walmart knows they're a predatory corporation. Walmart understands that as long as they keep their prices low, they can decimate your community. Because eventually, you'll start buying your tires from there, you'll start getting your car serviced there, you'll buy your groceries from there, you'll buy and do all business with Walmart. They knew this a long time ago. And they started going down this path a long time ago as they moved into your community, and look what is left of your community. Look what's left of the services that you have available. So Walmart didn't just do that on a competitive market. They got government to allow them to come in and operate these ways. And so, because I'll bet you anything, you don't live in the headquarters of Walmart. Headquarters is not, there's not a headquarters, an establishment of a unique Walmart in your state. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so when we look at taxes, we kind of look at taxes as kind of this equally applied, because a lot of people think that when government creates favors, they don't look at that as a taxation. When governments have allowed and actually have created laws, and you've heard me kind of gripe about this, where the tire industry has come in and created laws almost in every state that even though you're driving on tires that will actually move that car and move that car safely as long as it's driven in its proper capacity of serving you. In other words, you don't want to drive fast on wet roads with bald tires. Therefore, you have to drive really slow, and so you may not, if you can't keep the speed limit, then you shouldn't drive that car. So, in other words, we have, and for a society, we have lived a long time where we made those decisions. Well, government has created a law because the tire industry has convinced them that once your tread gets down below a certain degree, below a certain measure, that company will actually and have the right to tell you they can't touch your tire. They can't put that tire back on. They took the tire off, and then now that the tire is off, they said, we can't put this tire back on because the law won't let us. You have to buy a new tire. So let's look at that. People don't even consider that a tax. But over time, let's just say you could have gotten another year's use out of those tires. Another year's use. And so every time you buy tires, let's say your average use is 3-4 years, and you get a fifth year or fourth year, or fourth or fifth year, then over the course of your life, you've been taxed an extra set of tires or two. Probably more in the case of two, since those laws, if you're a very young age. An older person, they may only be inflicted by maybe one extra set of tires, but I wouldn't be surprised if you use your tires and you drift with your car, what have you. Drifting is using basically high-speed revolutions on your tire to where they're kind of smoking and going sideways to where your car is sliding sideways. That's drifting. So what I'm basically trying to assert is that law, it becomes a taxation on you. Now, does it actually affect you only? No, it affects everybody that has to buy tires for their vehicles. Those who use public transportation aren't affected by that. And remember, there's this little thing called the uniformity clause, where they kind of create these types of rules that said, you know, hey, you can't do that. You have to apply the taxation as equally applied. So for some reason, it's okay to basically take money out of your pocket, but the government, actually, who subsidizes the public transportation and so forth, they give themselves an advantage. Because it's just in the sauce, because where do they get the money from to subsidize their public transportation? Ah, probably from those people who are actually driving cars. Because most of those people are, you know, active, productive in society and so forth. Not all of them, but most. But anyway, my point is this, folks, is that when government starts playing around with corporations, giving them advantages and helping them make more money at your expense, then they're taking your property. Now, let me get back to this. A just security to property is not afforded by that government under which unequal taxes oppresses one species of property and reward another species. Where arbitrary taxes invade the domestic sanctuaries of the rich and excessive taxes grind the face of the poor, where the keenness and competitions of want are deemed an inefficient spur to labor or insufficient spur to labor, and taxes are again applied by an unfeeling policy, another spur in violation of that sacred property which heaven, in decreeing man to earn his bread by the sweat of his brow, kindly reserved to him in the small repose that could be spared from the supply of his necessities. If there be a government, then, which prides itself in maintaining the inviolability of property, which provides that none shall be taken directly, even for public use, without indemnification to the owner, and yet directly violates the property which individuals have in their opinions, their religions, their persons, and their faculties, nay, more, which indirectly violates their property in their actual possessions, in the labor and acquires their daily subsistence, and in the hallowed remnant of time, which ought to relieve their fatigues and soothe their cares, the influence or inference will have been anticipated that such a government is not a pattern for the U.S. Now, one of the things he kind of talks about is, he goes, basically, we have this kind of right to be able to rest and actually, you know, relieve ourselves from our fatigues of work and labor in supporting ourselves from the sweat of our brow. Our government is no longer giving us that. You've heard us say this, many people say this, that evil does not sleep. And evil has been encroaching and encroaching and encroaching and encroaching. And because we've taken the time to rest, we've reached a point where rest can no longer be found. If we're to fight this country, or if we're to fight, actually, not the country, but if we're to fight to get the rule of law restored, if we're going to take back the country, if we're going to actually become a self-governed people again, folks, just prepare yourself to be tired and exhausted. Because it is not something that is going to be done with the few fleeting moments of time you have during a week or month. This requires your focus. This requires your attention and your all. All hands on deck. We need to actually start understanding that we are the problem until we actually take a stand. And until we actually do everything we possibly can, and if still that's not enough, then you need to start asking, what more do I need to do, or how can I do this better? Businesses are very smart in innovating and improving their processes. We need to be equally smart in innovating and improving this process. When you look at what we've got regarding petitions and public campaigns and so forth in getting your government back, we're not talking about the buildings. We're not talking about the artifacts that are created. We're talking about the people that are sitting in those seats who are obviating their responsibilities and who are actually doing the deeds and the actions that are unconstitutional, that they should not be participating in. So the onus is on you. The onus is on me. We, the people, we have to do this. And as I've said, when I sit down with public servants who really want to do the right thing, they just don't know. You have to teach them. These petitions are designed to educate them as well as you. Read these petitions. You'll actually see that there is no argument in supporting a treaty with a foreign entity that was going to subjugate us to law. They have no enumeration to do this. Same thing with the invasion. Their responsibility is to repel invaders, not to allow them to stay here, and then grant them citizenship. They don't even have the constitutional authority to do that. Go back to the original definitions of where the citizenship spark lies. The citizenship spark lies with the states. Go read the 1795 Act, an act for a uniform rule of naturalization. I know it's all, they used to use mouthfuls for the titling of their acts and laws. But nonetheless, we have to start demanding compliance of the Constitution so that they fulfill their oaths of office. We are literally living in a time that you cannot qualify what is happening in America a constitutional crisis. Even with Trump as your president, he is basically continuing the constitutional crisis. Until he starts exercising and fully supporting the Constitution, he is only contributing to bad government. He's not even in government yet. But I'm here to tell you, as he actually writes those EOs, as he does the things that he's going to do, because I see those things, that the dominoes are set. He is going to be contributing to the sealing of the deal of America sliding into the globalist arms. The only way we back out of this is by obtaining constitutional compliance. So if you really think he's going to make things better, the better will only be temporary. And even though you may think that going into the federal currency or the, you know, some cryptocurrency, some blockchain currency, which is what they're doing, which is crypto, right? They're just using a different name for it with FedNow and the federal currencies. Bottom line, folks, stop. Stop. Stop supporting these unconstitutional things. Any American that's heavily invested in cryptocurrency and trying to use it as legal tender for the payment of debt, they're violating the Constitution. Folks, we have a responsibility. We can't expect our public servants to abide by the Constitution when we're actually running roughshod over it. So, Madison basically states this in his final paragraph. If the United States mean to obtain or deserve the full praise due to wise and just governments, they will equally respect the rights of property and the property in rights. Remember, he said that before, that if you have rights in your property, then you have property in your rights, which is why he just said, will equally respect the rights of property and the property in rights. They will revile, hold on here. So what's, they will oppose, how about that? They will oppose repelling its example in violating the latter, which makes themselves a pattern to that and all other governments. Folks, we actually have to start using our God-given rights of demanding compliance to our Constitution. Every time a new person gets chosen to go into office, if they haven't signed the pledge that they will support the Constitution, then we're screwed. Because they're going to be taught how it's done, and they're going to just further this push going down this path, or they may, you know, change the direction from a unrighteous, or I should say, a progressive, secular, godless path, and move it towards a conservative, you know, good, righteous path of tyranny. Pick your tyranny. It's tyranny nonetheless. It's two sides of the same coin. Progressive, godless, immoral tyranny, or conservative with a spin of Christianity tyranny. Remember, every monarchy in Europe were basically monarchical theocracies. Monarchical theocracies. They were all based on serving their God and fighting wars in his name. And they didn't stop. And they kept on. This is why these one nation opposed another to become the empire. When basically Britain, the little kid in the whole European theater, the little kid became the emperor. So, I find it really interesting that, you know, as we look at history and we kind of examine things, we go, how did that happen? Anyway, so the next thing we want to talk about, or the next thing I need to cover, is the scale of liberty, because liberty is quintessential to the desire of what we want government to do. When we look at the scale of liberty, and I've covered this before, on one side it is blank, it is white, it is transparent, it has no blackness, it is the emanation of pure white light. As you go from the left to the right, you will find shades of gray getting darker and darker and darker to when you reach the end on the right side of the scale, and I'm just using that as a, you know, as a measure so that we all think left to right. And on the far right side of the scale, at the very end, it is pure black. There is zero transparency, there is zero light, and as a matter of fact, it absorbs light. In other words, light does not exist, and the existence of light on the far end, pure light and emanation of light, blinding light, all-consuming light, all-consuming blackness. So when we look at the paradigm of people in the position of that pure white liberty, the people that are there cannot fathom, they cannot think of ever forcing somebody to do something. Their paradigm is to try to ensure that you're educated, that you will make your own decisions and understand that with those decisions come consequences. As a matter of fact, those people over on that side, they may have made their own decisions and mistakes, and they may have drifted a little bit to the right, but they have found their way back to the pure light. When we look at people today, and we look at conservatives, every time they want to create a law, like, I'll give you a good example, the Prohibition Law, basically taking away the ability for somebody to choose for themselves whether they're going to drink hard liquor or not. Anytime that you regulate morality, anytime that you regulate anything that you feel is wrong or doesn't belong, we shouldn't do that, like murder or what have you. Now, just keep in mind, you when we start, you know, regulating bullying to say you can't use, you know, words to hurt people's feelings, that goes beyond the pale. That actually moves you towards the black. Nobody likes bullying. And actually, parents have been failing in educating their children. When a child has not been well grounded and founded in the concepts of liberty and their rights to be able to withstand whatever comes from whatever comes in the onslaught from those who are trying to do harm. We can't regulate. What we have to do is we actually have to look at these people, and we have to cast them out of our own presence. In other words, if we need to go away or we basically just ignore whatever, sticks and stones break our bones, but words should never hurt us. They may be the truth, and the truth can hurt, but the fact that they're speaking the truth should not really be an indictment. It's bottom line, it's the truth. You've made those decisions, those are the consequences that come with it. Whatever the truth is, if the truth is something pure and Christ-like, and that's what you're there, and they call you, you know, a Jesus freak, they call you all sorts of different names. So what? it's a sad day that we're in this position where conservatives are supporting any type of rules or any type of regulations that actually allow the compelling of others. I see way too many conservatives that think the welfare system is important. The welfare system is important in the compassionate services of religion, in the compassionate services of your community, not your government. In other words, let those who want to support others in helping them get up and dust themselves off and become self-sufficient. There is no greater righteous blessings that one can receive than actually making sacrifice in helping others. We're promised blessings when we do this. And as a matter of fact, I'll paraphrase Malachi. You know, where do thee rob God? Ye rob him in his storehouses, because you have not honestly and willingly given up of your sacrifices, because they were doing sacrifices on a regular basis so that they could actually take care of those who were in need. And people weren't honestly basically paying their sacrifices. I wrote this in my first book, that if America actually paid a full tithe and paid honest, you know, offerings for them doing without when they actually fast, and if we went back to regular fasting as a nation, then I'm telling you folks, it's not that we wouldn't have the needy. The size of the needy wouldn't be what it is today. If religion basically said, okay, you know, we respect the fact that you're godless. We respect, you know, here's a person that is in full need. They went through the secular godless world and everything else. And so this person really needs help. So what ends up happening, if we didn't have any welfare system in the government, and government says, hey, you got a person over there that's kind of hurting, can anybody help them? Well, I think everybody should go in and say, you know, we'll help you if you're a member of our service, or we will give you some assistance. We'll all kind of work together to give you some assistance, but for us to really help you, you have to be willing to help yourself. You have to be able to stand on your own two feet. Now, there are organizations that I wouldn't say are denomination specific, like the Salvation Army. They're good organizations that try to help these people. Just like Alcohol Anonymous, AA. You know, AA built its base on God. That there is a supreme power, and that you have to go through these steps to basically turn your life around. And a part of that is repentance. Those types of foundational things actually really do help and work by helping people turn their life around. Now, some people can do this on their own, but most people need help. They need the community to do this. It doesn't necessarily have to be your church, but bottom line, if a person is not willing to become self-sufficient and they want to demand that you take care of them, then you have to put them out. I'm of the opinion, and as harsh as this may seem, we do have obligations of trying to help. But if a person is not willing to change their circumstances and they're absolutely happy being in the gutter, you know, being drunk and, you know, high on fentanyl or whatever it is, they want to destroy their life, you can't save them. Only they can save themselves. And you can pray for them. You can go and talk to them and say, please, you know, get out of this. Get your head right. And in so doing, if that person actually starts getting their head right, they will actually become self-sufficient if they follow these programs that we've innovated over time. Churches and communities have the responsibility of doing this. And I'm telling you, the majority of the people that are in this, you know, this welfare state, the entitlement state, many of those people, as soon as the entitlement state ends, as soon as we stop paying money, as soon as Trump says there's no right of welfare, we are not supposed to be doing this. This is not a constitutional process. This is what I was saying in my last president, you know, constitutional presidency, and it's going into tomorrow. The bottom line is, if government is not spending money on things that it shouldn't, then the inflation or the bleeding and the exacerbating of inflation stops. And we can actually start reducing the inflation. Inflation is not necessarily these arbitrary things that affect the value of money. It is very specific. The greater the circulation of money is in our system, the less it is valued. The only way to appreciate the dollar is to reduce the amount of dollars in circulation. You want to appreciate, if you're a tomato grower and you want to, you know, create the highest price for tomatoes, you have to convince all of the other tomato growers to stop growing so many and actually grow such a small amount where you can actually make your tomatoes worth gold. But you got to remember that people will look at a tomato and say, I'm willing to pay this price, but I'm not willing to pay $40 for a tomato. That's ridiculous. So there has to be a sweet spot of what you can sell your tomatoes for. And you will find that at the grocery store, when the tomatoes reach a certain price, they start rotting and the grocery store throws them away. And they start buying less from you. So it's called supply and demand. That's what a free market is. We're supposed to be living on free market policies, not these policies of mercantilism. Mercantilism is a policy where government basically sets all the standards and processes, and they basically limit the production or support the production of certain things. They should not have their hand. There is no constitutional authority for them to be involved in our economy, nor even in these exchanges. And as a matter of fact, folks, you need to look at exchanges as tools of your community, not tools of the nation and the world, because that's what has happened by creating these big, huge powerhouses. What we really need to start reevaluating what we're doing. But at this point in time, I've realized that I've kind of covered the scale of liberty, I hope. The whole point on the scale of liberty is you should actually feel ill if you have to feel like you have to compel somebody to do something. If it's your child and you feel like that's the best way to raise them, by compulsion, by the stick and the carrot, or some other way of incentivizing them. People need incentives. Survival is a great incentive. Do not underestimate the desire of survival. People will be willing to steal or do what have you to survive. So we have to actually help lead them, incentivize them on these principles of not just physical survival, but spiritual survival as well. So that we understand the importance of compassion, that we understand the importance of empathy, folks. We should actually just go into convulsions when we are involved in trying to compel anybody to make a certain decision. We have to respect the decisions of others. We have to respect the fact that some people may want to do something, but if the majority of your society and your community is at a point where you want to end abortion, then you can end abortion. And then that person will have to go to that community or society that allows it. It is that simple. But the point is that we have to start working together in on the cause of liberty to make sure that we all have the freedom to choose for ourselves. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.